the more genuine you stay to who you are and the more consistent you stay, because people can detect when you're trying to be consistent and when you're communicating outside of your standard kind of style, I think that that goes over pretty well.
This is Taking the Lead, a podcast for B2B tech professionals, leaders, and executives who want to learn from female icons in the tech industry. In each episode, host Christina Brady interviews women who are driving revenue for some of the most respected tech companies in the world. Are you ready to get inspired?
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Taking the Lead. I am Christina Brady. I am the SVP of Sales at Speckit, and I am so excited for my incredible guest today. Welcome, Marina, to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
I am incredibly excited to have you. You have had so far not only a wonderful journey across multiple aspects of the current company that you're at ShipBob, you are currently the SVP of North American Sales there, but you've had a wonderful journey before that as you've sort of ascended the ladder and gotten this incredible experience to finally land as one of these iconic women leading tech teams. Tell us a little bit of your journey and how you got where you are.
Okay, I would love to. So I'm going to take this back a little bit pre-career here. So I was actually born in the former Soviet Union, and my family immigrated here from Ukraine when I was six. And when we got here, you know, you hear about the land of opportunity. I'm 6 years old. What do I know? I just want ice cream. But like, I am ready to pursue everything that's given to me. And so I would say right around middle school, when everybody, I'm dating myself here, but everyone was wearing Abercrombie, you know, and all I wanted in my life was an Abercrombie t-shirt. And there was no chance at that point that my parents were buying me a $60 t-shirt. And so I went and got a job at Abercrombie. And I just felt like I had a cheat code for life. I was like, wait, I could just go get a job, earn money, get a discount, and buy the Abercrombie shirt myself. So I would say like my career ambitions started right around then, when I was like, this is just like a hack. And I think what's interesting is what my family instilled in me is, this kind of opportunity doesn't happen everywhere, right? Like if they hadn't made the decision to move over here, if we hadn't made that journey over, like who knows what I would be doing right now. And so that's always kind of stuck with me. So now we'll fast forward. I'll skip high school and move. graduating, you know, and so 2008-09 was a pretty bad recession. Couldn't find a job. So I was bartending. And as any of you sales folks know, bartending is the best sales training you'll ever get. And so learned a lot about hustle there and about kind of writing your own paycheck. So it transitioned pretty seamlessly into a business development role that I was finally able to find with Echo Logistics. So I kind of got my foot in the door over with kind of a startup at the time. This is when Groupon was blowing up. And so it was an exciting time. And from there, it was kind of a typical sales climb from BDR to AE, moved over to another startup in Boston to be an individual contributor there. That startup awkwardly got acquired by Echo. So I was like, okay, I'm out. And, and I would say the big kind of breakthrough for me was when I went over to Trunk Club, back when Trunk Club was a pretty small company, probably about 150 people or so. And we were just in Chicago. And so I really got to experience the startup life as an individual contributor, then as a sales manager. And then that's where I really made the decision to go into leadership. And one of my mentors, who's really a super close friend and somebody who has heavily influenced my career, said, like, you should give this a shot. And that's when I went into the sales director role, spent 5 years there. It was incredible. And then from there, with one other startup in between, I hopped over to ShipBob. So it's been 4.5 years at ShipBob, came in as a sales director, and very, very proud to say that I've had 3 promotions and had 2 kids while I was there. So 3 promotions, 4 years, 2 kids.
I love that your whole life changed, like your whole life evolved while you were there. And you also, you worked on different sides of the business. You've been in sales, you've been in CS, I think. I don't know if I would say that that's unique, but it's difficult because those are 2 very, very different sides of the business. And in most cases, they're 2 sort of separate sides of the business. And then they sort of eventually merge into one where you have sort of this executive ownership over both of those. How did you wind up hopping from one side to the other?
Well, there is the pretty story and then the actual story. So the, you know, I started as a account executive director, worked really closely with the sales team for the majority of my time at ShipBob. And then at one point after I came back from maternity leave for my second daughter, I was tapped on the shoulder and asked, hey, can you make the success team think a little bit more like a sales team, a little more proactive, a little bit more, you know, kind of in the weeds with the customers. And I was like, ooh, success, that is rough, right? Because I feel like you kind of choose, you're either sales or you're success. And it's really hard to do both. And there's probably a connotation built up in your mind about like, oh, I love the thrill of the chase and closing the business and like setting my customers up for success. But really kind of what happens afterwards, I don't know if that's really my forte. But I was tapped on the shoulder by my CRO, Paul Rosen. And it was one of those things that ShipBob has always been so good to me that I've always been agreeable to doing whatever they need from me, even though I had some concerns and trepidation. But Paul, being the excellent salesperson he is, said, well, you want to be a CRO at some point, right? And I was like, yeah. He's like, this is pretty important. That's the only thing missing from your resume. And I was like, sold. And so now
that'll do it.
And that was 3 quarters ago, so Q2 last year. And it's been an incredible experience, truly. Like the success team is so amazing and we've done great things together and we've been able to move the needle rather quickly because they were so willing to work with me and kind of see my vision. And I actually think not having that experience, almost that like blissful ignorance, made me a little bit more impactful because I came in with a fresh set of eyes and I just started questioning things that were already kind of a part of their day-to-day process and have been for years. And I'm like, but why do we do it like that? And so they were open to me kind of shaking things up and it's been great.
I mean, the evolution that you naturally made is incredible because successful companies don't look at their customers in siloed pieces. Now, granted, you have to have leaders in both sides of the business that are maniacally focused on what they're doing, but you have to look at it as an entire customer journey from the moment that we are interacting with the customer. And that could be the marketing engine, that could be a BDR, that could be an AE, it could be at a conference, it could be anywhere, but I'm interacting with the customer. That is day one in the customer life cycle with your company, all the way until they're renewing and renewing. And so when you look at that entire vision, it makes sense that you have, at least at the executive level, one person who says, I want to make sure that this entire journey is serving the customer and making the product light up the way that it absolutely should and creating this customer loyalty and increasing the amount of logos that we have and how many of them retain. But it's difficult when you first start to look at the two sides of the business, because to your point, they are so different. And so now, sitting all the way at the top and viewing it, do you find now that you have the very natural muscle to look at the customer journey as holistic versus more kind of compartmentalized?
Yes, 100%. It's been so, so valuable for me because, you know, on the sales side, you sell the dream. But once you know what's going to happen in the life cycle of the journey and you know if you're setting up your success team for success, you kind of pull back on the dream and sell some of the reality as well. And so it's allowed me to create some alignment all the way across the board from BDR, AE, implementation over to success and make sure that that customer doesn't have a fragmented journey that can naturally happen when you only have leaders that are specializing in, you know, their department. And I don't know if I've ever given you my analogy for the customer journey, but I feel like at the BDR level, you're on the apps, you're on Tinder, you're swiping left and right. With AEs, you're dating and it's like great and you're just getting to know each other. You're selling the dream. It's awesome. Then you get engaged. You go to implementation and implementation is the wedding, right? It's fast and it's intense and it's like a little bit stressful, but like you're like, hell yeah. And then you're married and that is the rest of your life. And for those of us who are married, you know that there might be some ups and downs in that. And we're in it for the long haul and we're going to do this together and it's a partnership and it takes communication, but it ain't easy. And so
Oh my gosh. I love it. My husband and I just celebrated our 10-year wedding anniversary and I was like, I think we should renew. And he was like, what? And I was like, never mind. My friends would get it. You don't get it.
Congrats. That's amazing.
I was like, we're going to renew. You know, it's funny, as two former bartenders in 2008, I said, you and I might have been bartending at bars next to each other in 2008. But we saw a lot of people trying to sell the dream there to each other, you know? So we also have the life experience of watching all of that happen. And you mentioned this idea of almost a fragmented journey and how that can happen. But internal company movement can sometimes feel fragmented too. You had to switch from different sides of the business, which means you were moving around, you were leading different people, you were leading different departments, you were having to work with maybe new or different cross-functional partners. Did you ever feel like the internal journey was somewhat fragmented, if not only for you, but also for your people? And how do you get buy-in when you're having to move around and lead so many different people and so many different departments?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I'm going to say this and it's going to sound bad, but it's not a bad thing. I have trouble with boundaries in a sense that I won't fully leave behind what I've already collected because it seems like a waste. Like I have that experience. I have those relationships in place. So I'm not going to say, all right, forget you AEs. I'm with Success now and I'm not talking to you anymore. So it was really, I was building upon the old experience and just adding the new. And it sounds like it's a lot of work, but the old experience came so naturally to me that it just made sense to add on. And so I think like it's more, we brought everybody together more than just continue to keep that fragmented trend.
Yeah. And with new people all the time that you were leading, interacting with, I mean, I think I love how you put it. It's like, I don't have boundaries, but what I think it means is that you want to show people that you're a human being. You want to connect with them. You want to learn about them. And it ultimately comes from a place of wanting to impact them. And yeah. In your mind, what do you think are the ways that you show people immediately that you're able to impact them and that you care?
Yeah, I mean, the feedback I've always gotten, and I love, you know, peer reviews, feedback I've gotten is like, there is a radical transparency and a good mix of nurture and toughness that you get. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the radical transparency piece is, I think people are so much more bought into their individual role when they know what's happening with the company. And so basically anything I know, my managers know. Anything that is kosher for me to share, I am sharing as soon as I know it. Because these changes, especially in the startup world, they happen so quickly. And people don't like feeling like they're only being pulled in once it's like a fully baked product and they don't have any say in it. And so that's the way I've always gotten buy-in from my managers, is I've made them a part of the journey. And the reality is they're going to have a point of view that I'm not going to have in their day-to-day. So it actually is so valuable. So I think that's part of it. Second part is like, we're all people, you know, I've always loved your take on work-life satisfaction. And for me, work-life satisfaction isn't you're done at 5, you start again at 9. It's like bringing it into your world. I'm not saying people have to overshare their personal lives, but I've always had great relationships with folks on my team. So I'll tell them about what I did over the weekend or, you know, dumb stuff I do. My Instagram is just my kids anyway, so I've got nothing to hide. If you want to follow me, go for it. So I think like humanizing yourself also and not just being the leader, but being a part of the team has always been really helpful.
I mean, that's a beautiful sentiment. And the transparency that you talk about, I almost feel like it can be a double-edged sword, because transparency is key to building a great company culture and to connecting with your people. But transparency is also really difficult at the executive level because there are certain elements of opaqueness that you have to have. And so have you found it ever difficult to be as radically transparent as you are and breed that as your company culture, but then have moments where you realize, I can't be transparent about this and I can't bring them in on this? And how do I not lose trust with my people? Because I have to draw the line somewhere at where I'm transparent with my people and where it doesn't make sense for me to actually be transparent about this. How do you think through that at the executive level?
It's definitely been an evolution, right? I joined ShipBob when we were just raising our Series C and we're now post Series E and have had tremendous growth over that time. And so obviously there's going to be more red tape. There's going to be more protocol. It's not just full startup mode anymore. Walk over to someone's desk and chat about what you just heard in a meeting. And so you balance it by obviously using your noggin and like knowing what it is okay to share and what's not, but also as a culture for a ShipBob, there's very little that we're ever told, hey, keep this under wraps. And I think that that really comes from the leadership level. Our C-suite has always been transparent with us. And I think they're not naive to the fact that once you let 5 or 10 people know something, it's going to disseminate, and that's a good thing. So I've never seen a level of radical transparency like I do here, like in my previous companies. I didn't know the financials week over week. I didn't know what was going on as an individual contributor. Here, everyone has access. From anyone in the company can know exactly where we stand week over week as a company if they'd like to.
Oh my gosh. I mean, and I think that's pretty rare. And that's a decision that executives have to make, but then you also have to do things a little bit differently because of that. You have to be very, very careful about the decisions that you make. Talk to us a little bit about how, if your company wants to take on this idea of not just the leaders being radically candid or transparent, but as a company, this is a value that we hold very, very dear, which means we all have to embody it. What kind of changes do you have to make to how you even process change or communicate to your teams? Because you always have this idea of transparency in mind. Are there areas where you feel like you've had to almost learn or do things differently to not slip up or make a mistake or communicate things incorrectly?
Yeah, the point of view I've always taken on it is what kind of value or devalue is this going to bring to the person I communicate this to? So like, am I sharing something that's going to bring them stress because they're not supposed to know this? And now they're going to have this like internal panic of like, why did she tell me this? And if the answer is even close to yes, like if it's not 100% no, then I'm not going to share it because I'm not going to put that kind of pressure on them. Because I've been on the receiving end of that position. You know, you find something out too early and you have to live with it for a long time, and it's going to impact people, and it's not a great feeling. So I look at it from that perspective. If it is going to bring them value, if it's going to make them feel more bought in, if it's going to allow us to gather their perspective and add value to whatever, you know, the project or product or initiative is, then I'll share it with them.
Oh my gosh. And then do you put yourself or your teams through any kind of actual communication training to make sure that you're heard and understood? Because there's a lot of nuances in communication and how you're heard, the method of communication that you use. And then, I mean, there's all kinds of socioeconomic factors that go into whether or not we are heard and understood the way that we want to be and interpreted the way that we want to be. Has that ever been something that has come across your plate where you're like, I wasn't heard the way I wanted to be heard, or I didn't communicate that the right way, or I was really, really transparent and it still went really, really south. And now what do I do?
Yeah. I mean, look, you're not going to please everyone. A great leader is going to be able to cater to the masses, right? But the reality is the way you deliver a message is not always going to resonate with everyone. And it's okay to have some of those one-off conversations. Like, I know how to tweak my style for one-on-one communication. When you're communicating with the entire revenue team, you know, it's 200 people at this point, like there is someone you might rub the wrong way. And what's important is keeping that open door policy, having them have this great buy-in with their manager where they could bubble up and say, hey, the way that Marina delivered that message the other day, I didn't love it. Great. Let's make sure that message gets back to me. Let's talk about it. Like, I will apologize for anything that, you know, wasn't well received. But at the end of the day, I think the more genuine you stay to who you are and the more consistent you stay, because people can detect when you're trying to be consistent, when you're communicating outside of your standard kind of style, I think that that goes over pretty well.
Oh man, that is such a good point around. Also, you're touching on like another big topic here, which is how companies actually are able to give feedback to their leaders and their executive leaders. And I don't know about you, but I see this as something that often has the very, very best of intentions, but isn't executed very well. Even just recently, I was talking to a couple of leaders who were saying, you know, I always ask my team directly for feedback, like their direct manager asking their direct team for feedback. And I said, well, how does that always go? Like, do you always get the feedback that you need? And they were like, well, you know, most of the time it's pretty positive, or I learn things that they really, really like. And I was like, do you really think it's a safe place to ask your people to give you constructive feedback directly? Because of the fact that there is, even if it feels really thin, there's a level there where there's a separation between the two of you and you are ultimately in charge of their career, and offending you means it could impact them. And so people feel trapped in this place of, I want to give my manager constructive feedback, but me doing that directly feels dangerous for so many reasons. Mm-hmm. And so how do you facilitate the giving and receiving of feedback when there's almost a hierarchy there to keep people safe and feeling safe.
Absolutely. It's so tough. I think one thing ShipBob does really well is we do an ENPS, right? So we do the internal NPS survey once a year. And a lot of questions around it are, how much do you trust your direct manager, your direct leader, and then leadership of the company? So that's one way. Second way is I report to our CRO, Paul. I do ask him for feedback from my direct reports. He does a ton of skip levels and talks to everybody on our team. And so if there's ever any feedback, like, at least I know that I have the relationship with him, that if he hears anything, he'll let me know, and vice versa, right? We kind of bounce ideas off of each other, and there's certainly no confusion about the delineation of the reporting structure, but we bounce feedback off of each other. Hey, how do you think that message was received? What could I have done differently, whether it's a client-facing call or an internal call? And so to have that open relationship, that's something that you do cultivate over time with someone. But again, it's just like showing that I'm not going to take it personally. I am truly searching for this, and I've gotten feedback before that's made me think twice and change my style. So I'm so grateful for that.
Well, I mean, even honing in right there, the feedback that you got before, was that in an anonymous setting where it was an NPS survey, something like that? You got the feedback and then you saw that and you were able to see, like, yes, I did that. I want to change that. How did you go about facilitating that change and communicating, hey, I got this feedback, I heard it, and now I'm making a change? How do you navigate that?
Yeah, so it was actually in a previous company, and it was a 360 review. And one of the pieces of feedback was, Marina uses humor to try to downplay tough situations. And I was like, oh shit, that's profound, because I definitely do that. You know, and so I was like, nailed it, whatever intuitive person this was. And I was thinking, like, okay, well, if someone's noticing that, then it's not going over all that well, like if they made it a point to bring this up. And so I said, you know what? That's absolutely true. I think it takes some emotional maturity to handle tough situations head on and not try to diffuse them using humor. And so I'm very cognizant of that now. And when we are having true, you know, big conversations, tough conversations, I'm just going to get straight to the point.
Oh my gosh, this is something that I feel like we could dig into for hours, because there is this idea that there's the right place for humor in difficult conversations when you need to maybe back off the severity of that, or you want to make the person feel a little bit more comfortable. But humor, especially as an executive, can become a crutch and can actually start to erode culture over time if you're not careful. And I think towing that line becomes increasingly difficult to figure out when do I just need to play this really, really straight and really, really serious and let the gravity speak for itself and let the gravity exist. Like, I don't know about you, but I find that less and less, especially in a remote culture, we are worried about letting gravity just exist and saying something that's hard and letting the feelings be in the room. We ultimately always feel the need to lighten the mood and say something else or cheer people up. And it sounds like you found a way to just let the moment be the moment.
Absolutely. I think it just, you lose so much impact if you try to gloss over something or if you try to sugarcoat something. And then it's like, what was the point of all of that effort, right? You wait for that moment, you prepare for that moment, and then you don't even get the gravity of your point across. So I do think, though, it's self-awareness, right? Like when someone said that to me and I read that in my review, I was like, it just hit me, right? They nailed it. And so I'm so grateful to whoever that person was, because now it's never going to happen again. I shouldn't say never, I'm human, but like, I'm so aware of it that I'm going to always look out for that. And I'm really appreciative of that.
I mean, you're human and you're also funny. And so the combination of those things, you're like, to find a moment to be human and not funny when I want to. But I remember at a previous company, I had a leader who was a wonderful individual, but geared on the side of too much humor and too much joking all the time. And I remember I was exposed to this leader for a couple of years and learned a ton from them. But I actually found that the fact that they never let moments have the impact that they needed to it actually bled into my leadership style a little bit. And I had to break the habit and I had to catch myself being like, oh, this is not a great time to throw out a joke or say something lighthearted or to pick fun at somebody. And it's almost like it's good that you heard the feedback and you were like, I need to make this change because it really can impact the way that people interact with each other at work. And when you're that person that can never take things seriously, I have seen that impact people's careers when they're not able to almost code switch like that and determine when do I need to let this be a real candid moment? And when can I be a little bit more jovial, a little bit more lighthearted and sort of show my personality a little bit? And so I don't doubt that you still have moments where you're able to let yourself and your personality shine a little bit, but you're almost prescriptive about it, which I think is really neat.
I mean, it's just nice to hear that it's not only me. I
it's
thought
not just, it's not just you.
Me problem. So great.
Well, yeah. I mean, coming from the comedy scene myself, you know, mm-hmm. I often sometimes I'm like, hey, people know that I'm this, you know, this performer and I do comedy. And it's almost like, well, like make me laugh, right? And I'm like, no, I have to find moments to be really, really serious. But on the other side of that, the other thing that I've often struggled with is, am I perceived the way that I want to be perceived in those moments where I'm having to be candid or in those moments when I'm having to drive or in those moments when I'm having to give somebody really, really difficult feedback? On the same token, when I'm being more lighthearted and more jovial and still want to get a message across, am I being taken seriously? But then also, am I being interpreted the right way when I'm trying to give a really, really straight message? Am I too forceful? Am I too aggressive? Like these are words that have kind of followed me around in my career that I'm also conscious of. So how do you put yourself in a place where you're not constantly judging every way that you come across to make sure that it's the right message at the right time?
Well, I will say I feel like that is a problem unique to being a woman in that we are constantly overthinking and questioning how is that being perceived? Am I being too direct, right? And what does direct for a woman mean? She's you know what? And what does, and then if we are using humor and we're trying to keep things lighthearted, then, oh man, she doesn't have the ability to be super direct. And like, is she really ready to be an executive? She can't deliver a strong message. And so this is something that we are constantly grappling with in our careers and probably outside of our careers as well. And so I have at times evoked, you know, maybe a male colleague who I look up to and say, well, how would they deliver this message? Like if they would deliver it, no BS, straight to the point, then I'm going to do that. And now it's become more second nature. And so I think I've been able to develop that spidey sense for what just needs that levity and what needs the gravity. But it certainly wasn't without a ton of overthinking and years of questioning myself.
Yeah. I mean, same. And it's like I try to be very careful about what I identify as being a gender issue versus just a personality issue. And that can get really, really blurred too. Because on the one hand, there have absolutely been times in my career where I've been perceived as too aggressive or too B-wordy, where I know I was not being aggressive. I was stating a point very, very factually and very unemotionally. And I'm being perceived that way because of a gender bias. There have been other times where I have been too aggressive and I have been too forceful. And it doesn't matter the gender that I identify with, because anybody communicating a message the way that I did would not be the most effective way to do it. And so it can be difficult. I think as a woman, speaking for myself, it can be difficult to identify, am I getting this feedback because of a bias, an unconscious bias even, that I now need to figure out how I grapple with because I don't want to change the way that I'm giving this message? Or, yeah, that's really good feedback. I do need to change that. And have you ever kind of had that struggle of like, what do I do with this feedback?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, again, it was going back to the original feedback of using humor in serious situations. I was like, why am I doing that? Am I uncomfortable delivering this message? Is it because I just don't want to face the conflict or the difficulty head on? And then it does make you think about your personal life and like, maybe my husband might say I'm not the best at communicating sometimes. I don't know. Problem. Just kidding. But
he would never. He would never.
But, you know, the reality is that it's the constant questioning of yourself, which I've seen from all people, regardless of gender identification or anything. Like I've seen men, women, everyone in between question themselves. And so I think that it's like adding that additional layer of, am I being questioned because I'm a woman? Am I getting this feedback because I'm a woman? And so I've stopped looking at things from that perspective. I'm just a professional. I'm just at work. I'm doing my thing and I'm not always going to get it right. And that's okay.
Yeah. Do you, I've got kind of a hot question for you that's making this come up. Do you believe that ultimately women in executive leadership, because we are expected to have this level of emotion, does that give us an advantage in our careers or a disadvantage in our careers? Because I've heard both sides of just whether or not that take on women in leadership, is that a good thing for us or a bad thing for us?
Yeah, great question. I've heard both sides as well. My personal opinion is because we are expected to perform at a certain level or with a certain level of emotion, when we come in and just say something really intelligent, it blows the room up because the expectation isn't that. And that is frustrating on the one hand, but on the other hand, let's just channel it to our advantage. I can't tell you how many times I've been in a room with men, I have said something and it's like, whoa, that was so profound. I'm like, no, it wasn't. You just didn't expect it to come from me. And like, that's the reality of it. And that's okay. Like, I'm actually so okay with that. And so then you feel empowered. It depends, right? How you take it. I feel empowered by that. And I'm going to keep rolling with it. And I'm just going to keep doing my thing. And like, you don't get to climb the ladder without just being an intelligent person who's capable of doing their job well, regardless of gender. But I'm going to take it as an advantage if the bar is for some reason.
Oh, I love this take. I love this take. I love when you said like, no, it wasn't profound. You just didn't expect it to come from me. That has a level of confidence and self-assurance to sit at the table by itself, speak up at the table, and then say something that could be challenging another point of view or saying something that can come off as really, really profound. And I think there's a lot of women or just people in the world who probably have this brilliance that's locked up inside of them and they don't know how to communicate it, or they're afraid to communicate it, or they're worried about the impact on their career. And what piece of advice would you give those folks who are wanting to communicate what's in their heart, but maybe don't feel like they have the freedom or the acumen or the ability to do so?
Yeah, it's such a great question and something I struggled with for a long time, because there would be times I'd be sitting at the literal table and something would come to mind that I thought could add so much value to this conversation, but it came so obviously to me that I thought that like, oh, everyone else has already thought of this. And so don't say it because you're going to look like an idiot. Like, okay, Captain Obvious. But then I started saying those things, right? And I started little by little, I got the confidence to start saying those things at the table. And people were like, huh. And I'm like, wait a minute. Maybe I do have something that someone else hadn't thought of. And maybe my point of view is valuable. And the reality is, as a sales leader, you know, I sometimes struggle with like, I don't deliver a physical product. Like I come into a room and generally like lend my opinion and steer and guide and help. And all of that is from what comes intuitively to me, right? And so my piece of advice is like, trust yourself. If your intuition is saying, say that thing, or why aren't they talking about this yet? It's because they hadn't thought of it. And because you have a unique perspective of point of view. And that's why you have a seat at the table to begin with.
Oh, I knew you'd have a good answer to that. There was no way that you wouldn't. And I feel like throughout the conversation today, you've given so many great nuggets for just finding your confidence and finding your voice and being unafraid of who you are. And I could go on all day, but instead, we're coming close to the end of time and I have to get in the rapid reveal. Are you ready for me to dig in a little bit further to who you are?
I am so ready.
All right, let's do it. I've got three questions for you. You've got a minute or less to answer each, although if we have to break that rule, we will, because it's interesting. So number one, who has made the biggest impact in your professional life?
Okay, so it's a tie. It's a two-way tie. The first is Nicole Gable. She was my director at Trump Club, and she and I got off to a rocky start. It was not all roses and sunshine before. It was just Nicole is the kind of person where you have to earn her time. And so when I first joined her team, I was like, help me, manager. And she was like, prove yourself first. And I was like, oh, what a bee, right? And then I was like,
how dare you?
So fired up that I was like, you know what? I will prove myself. Turns out she knew what she was doing, right? And so once I earned her time, she's one of my closest friends to date. She stood up in my wedding. She lives in Boston and is executive at Silicon Valley Bank now. And, you know, we go on vacation together a couple times a year. And so it's been an incredible relationship. And then the second person is Paul Rosen, who's the CRO at ShipBob. And Paul has just been a tremendous influence in every way because Paul has this unique ability to identify something in people before they see it in themselves and help you nurture it without kind of holding your hand. And so Paul, I think, saw something in me before I saw it in myself, helped me build up that confidence, helped me get to this level. He's been an absolute advocate for all of my positions at ShipBob. So I'm so grateful to him.
Oh, as somebody who also knows Paul Rosen, he's an absolute gem of a human being. And I'm glad that he made the list. All right, number two. What's an irrational fear of yours?
Okay, so I also have to, God, I need to get it together and just pick one, but—
You don't. This is perfect.
My silly irrational fear that's so weird is like, have you ever been under a bridge when the bridge goes up and those, like the mechanism that raises the bridge, like the gears or whatever, freak me out. They're so massive and so powerful. And when you're so close to them, and like, this will seem like a really weird one, but you know, the Groupon building was right on the river. And so I would constantly see the bridge come up and it would freak me out. Weird. I know.
Bridges. Great.
The second one is kind of losing everything I built, right? Like how reliant I am on continuing to be good at my job and to like continue to live this life that I've been able to build from scratch, right? Because when you come from a very different lifestyle to get to this point, to continue to stay motivated, you're like, but what if it all goes away? I don't think that there is a huge threat of that, but you live with it day to day.
Oh, you punched me in the feels with that one, right? The biggest fear of that. Am I Icarus flying too close to the sun? Am I going to lose everything if I make this one wrong move? And will the entire life as I know it revert? I mean, yeah, I don't, maybe that's, if that's irrational, we both have that one. My gosh. And number three, last but certainly not least, what is your favorite hobby?
I am my best self in a yoga studio and I love all my people, but when none of them are around me, not my kids, not my husband, not friends, not my coworkers, and I am just me, I am on that mat and it's 30 minutes. I do the hot, you know, hot, sweaty yoga with weights. And it's like, I can't think about anything else other than what's in that moment. And that is the only time my brain turns off. And it is just a glorious vacation.
Oh, God, I am jealous that your hobby is a very healthy one and that's your favorite. I wish that my favorite hobby were something that were so bodily enriching. So I'm just going to take a page out of your book and try to get there where my hobby is as healthy as yours. So many of the things that you said have been wonderful and healthy, and I imagine that folks are going to want to connect with you, talk to you a little bit more, even hear about what ShipBob is up to. So where can people go to find you, learn about you, talk to you?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn, Marina Golemis, G-O-L-E-M-I-S. It's weird. I'm still not used to it. Been married for 5 years. And also email me, mgolemis@shipbob.com. I'm always open to having a conversation. I love stuff like this. So thank you.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for being on the show. As I told all of you, she is wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. And we will see everyone next time. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Taking the Lead. If you're looking for more inspiring stories from women leaders in B2B tech, then visit us at motionagency.io/takingthelead.